Hey folks, welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. What you're about to listen to is an edited for audio version of a Zoom conversation that I had with Judy Heppner. Judy is part of the community at The Table, and we've been talking between ourselves for a long time about all sorts of things that challenge us. And as part of our wider consideration of finding common ground with folks, we wanted to talk about some things that might help us all think about having hard conversations. So we did that on Zoom, and that was something we shared with the community. This is the edited version of that conversation. I hope that you find it catalytic in the best sense when it comes to hard conversations that might be part of your own life experience. Thanks for listening.
All right, so let's get going. So okay. to those that are just watching this, what you need to know, I think, is that Judy and I have been having a conversation about having difficult conversations for quite a long time. And the context for that is not infrequently conversations her and I are having that either one of us or both of us are finding challenging, because we both like to explore what we believe. And there are some substantial worldview segments, I would say, that while we have common ground in them, we also have divergent views in them. And when we explore those together, sometimes we find it challenging. And we've been able to keep going, which is delightful to me. And along the way, one of the things that I've learned about Judy is that having difficult conversations is not just something she does well, but something she's thought about and read about and contemplated, as well as practiced. So given that we've been doing a bunch of exploring about some of these things that have to do with public discourse, with talking about and to people with whom we disagree, talking about ideas we don't share or have in common, in an attempt to find the best sort of common ground for us as a species so we can live well together. One of the skill sets that seems to be in decline in general is the ability to have difficult conversations with one another. Whether that's as a matter of public discourse in the formal sense of politics or law or, you know, sort of formal social society making, or whether it's just, you know, your neighbor across the fence, or whether it's your family member across the dinner table. These are things that we need to learn how to converse with one another about so that we can make progress toward a better shared understanding of things. Doesn't mean we all end up in the same place. But it does mean that we're able to know one another more deeply as different from ourselves and not be afraid. I think that's sort of really at the heart of it, in my experience anyways. We don't have to run away from that which is not like us or our preferences. So what we wanted to do together today was talk about that a little bit. And my hope is personally, sort of selfishly, but also collectively, that we can mine some of Judy's thoughts about this and her experience and sort of just see where that takes us. I so miss doing these things live. It almost aches to set this up and do it this way. And yet I'm also really glad that we can do this. So, all right, away we go. So Judy, let's start with why is this so damn hard? Like why, not this conversation, which I'm not finding difficult, but at least not yet. You know, maybe we'll make it difficult as we go. But as humans, why do we find it so challenging to have conversations with people that hold a different position on something, or that have a different worldview, or that are different from us in some way that just feels like something we have to get over or get past? What is it about us as humans that makes having these kinds of conversations such a challenge?
My thinking on this has been really influenced by people coming from a variety of disciplines, like evolutionary biologists, psychologists, social psychologists, things like that, but there's kind of a line that runs all throughout there. It's just that we are so influenced by our genetics. We are so influenced by how millennia of humans needed to operate to survive. And even though we've maybe had these changes in, you know, fairly recent history as far as history goes about like living not just in small tribal groups, but in much larger societies, our genetics and our way of our brain's way of operating hasn't really caught up with that, because change at that level doesn't happen instantly. So the idea of tribalism and having the people on our side and the people are on the other side, and we stick together with people on our side and we don't, we are against the people on the other side, is something that's very hardwired into us because it helped us survive. Yeah, and now that, we don't have, go ahead.
I was just going to say that, that picture that we have when we think about, when we imagine this ancient or prototypical human, the saber-toothed tiger, enemy tribes person illustration, right? That if you're different than me, that threatens my survival at some core level.
Yeah.
And that seems to be rooted so deeply in our physiology and our neurobiology and our psyches as well, that to be able to kind of look at somebody that is different than me and go, no, those things are not at risk. We don't seem to be there without a deliberate effort.
Yep, exactly. And so that actually happened to me, not even terribly far off, is that I remember being in the middle of a conversation and just suddenly my amygdala was flashed on, and I had two urges, and they were the fight and the flight. Cause I either, my first thought was, I want to say something. And then I wasn't sure if I should say something. And then my second thought was, I should just leave this conversation. And reflecting on that later, I realized, even though it was not a life-threatening situation, which I rarely have in at all, it was somehow very threatening to me to have somebody who was saying something that different than something that I dearly held.
You know, that's such a tricky moment in conversations, isn't it? Because I just think you did a great job there, Judy, of illustrating something that we might not think of as fight or flight. You used the phrase, I wanted to leave the conversation, right? Yeah. There's so many ways to leave a conversation, right? You can still be in the room. You can still be across the table from the person, and you can have left the conversation so thoroughly, right? And so to recognize, to kind of correlate that impulse to step back from the conversation, make a deflecting joke, change the subject, go for a coffee refill, you know, whatever it is, right? But these myriad ways that we have of kind of getting out of the danger zone, to correlate that with that primal instinct to run. That's a really important correlation, right? Because that's the depth at which our bodies, among other things, are processing the sense of threat.
Mm-hmm. And another core way we seem to work is that while we think of ourselves as rational creatures, and I talked about that when we had that one thing where I talked about the book, The Righteous Mind.
Yeah.
We are more like a rider and the elephant, where the elephant is our impulses, kind of what we want to believe, what we would like to be true. And the rider's job is not to direct the elephant. It is to come up with reasons for why the elephant is going where the elephant is going. Another way of thinking that is the term motivated reasoning, that we want our ideas to win. So we look for the proof that backs us up, and we ignore what doesn't match us. And these are not character deficits. These are human condition. And being aware of that, I think, helps us to have better conversations.
Yeah, one of the ways, not to get too far afield on this, but one of the ways that we can leave conversations, or one of the things that can happen inside of us when we get into those moments and go, oh, I'm not really being my best self in this conversation, is that then we can sort of feel ashamed, right?
Yeah.
If we want to do well, or if we're motivated to have the conversation or to connect with the person or whatever, and that's where we start. So we start from this good place, and then we have this not good feeling experience, and then we feel bad about having had the experience, and then it's over, right?
Yeah.
And so being able to kind of recognize what you just named, I think, is so important, where we say, this isn't, I don't even have to blame this on my mother. Like, I don't have to therapeutically process this. I can just go, this is a human instinct. And when I can name it that way and start there, those other things might be at play, but they really might not. Then I can kind of go, okay, now let's, if I start there, then I can ask myself a question about what is it about this idea that makes me feel afraid or feel threatened? Or what is it about this position or even this person that's backing me up? What do I think is going on here? Or what do I don't even think is the right word. What is my oldest part of my brain even telling me is going on here? What's the threat?
Yeah, it goes to kind of what I talk about in my work a lot, is that our emotions are a message to us. And if we can stop and listen to what the message is telling us, that will help us to navigate this better. And what you mentioned about shame is really important, because shame is often at the root of a lot of these difficulties. Even the idea of, what if I'm wrong about something? That can bring this deep sense of shame. I know for myself that would be something that's like, if I'm wrong, does that mean I'm stupid? And I don't want to be stupid. I want to be intelligent. So I just having that in mind about what is this emotion that I'm having, first of all, not reinterpreting it as something else. Like something that you'll often hear people say is things like, well, I felt disrespected. And at times like that, what I would do in my work is I'd go, disrespect isn't an emotion. It's, you know, you may have been disrespected, I don't know, but what's the emotion that you're feeling right now? And often isn't something like shame, frustration, sadness, anger. Mm-hmm. Actually recognize our emotions for emotions can be really important.
I was just thinking that if we're going to do this with a broad stereotype brush, then if I'm a woman, I might be feeling ashamed. And if I'm a man, I might be feeling angry. Like we have these... if we're disrespected, let's say, right? Yeah. So these would be archetypal or stereotypical ways of understanding those things on the basis of how we're conditioned to think of ourselves and our position vis-a-vis this other person.
And in reality, often we feel both. We feel anger and we feel shame.
Right.
And we will be willing to recognize one or the other depending on what that means for us.
Yeah. And sometimes too, Karine and I were actually, we were talking about this conversation that you and I were going to have and what we were going to be talking about, and touch a little bit on how when somebody presents us with an idea that challenges our worldview or our lived experience, we can sort of feel like all the hard work that we've done to build a framework around our experience that helps us not have to think about what it means all the time, framework can get shaken. That was a cumbersome sentence, but like we do a lot of this work as humans, and we kind of have to, right? Because if we're always processing everything, we're just mush. Like we can't get anything done. And so we make these frameworks that help us to set certain questions aside and say, I've got a way of thinking about that. And then if we encounter an idea in someone else's in conversation or in someone else's lived experience, they're telling of their story that challenges that framework, it can feel like there's a whole lot of shaking going on.
Yeah.
We might not even be conscious of that.
Yeah. Do you remember once when I was teaching and I used that, what is it called? That ball that expands and things like that. And yes. I pointed out that sometimes when you're going through those kinds of worldview shifts, when something that you believe is challenged, it doesn't just affect that. It starts to reverberate until like you feel shaken. And that is something that's deeply threatening to us.
Absolutely. I wanted to also circle back to just a little bit to something you said earlier. You were talking about the disrespect illustration. Like I felt disrespected, mm-hmm. and how just feeling disrespected is not an emotion. Emotional, which is just true. Emotional literacy, like or intelligence or whatever sort of descriptor we want to use there, that's really important in having difficult conversations, isn't it? To be able to name what we're feeling in those moments is really important. And again, we could go down this other, this path, you know, in just this one, but But it's remarkable to me how little most of us know about our own emotions and naming them. Is there, if we're in the middle of a difficult conversation and we realize we're feeling strongly about it, our body's sending us all those signals that say there's something going on here that's about strength of emotion. Is there something, I'm going to say simple, that we can do to sort of hit the pause button without telling the other person, you know, I have to go to the bathroom now. Like I have to leave the room. Like, is there an internal anything that can kind of help us go check in? What can I do to kind of stay in this conversation?
Sometimes noting the emotion itself is enough to kind of give it the attention that it needs in the moment.
So just sort of naming it, I feel angry.
Yeah. This is making me angry. This is making me uncomfortable. Something about this is bothering me.
Yeah.
And then you kind of give yourself permission to come back to that later.
That's what I was just going to say. For me, that's the sticky note. That's the mental sticky note, right? And I don't know, I had a colleague for many years who we were having a conversation one day about how unsolved leadership problems can keep you up at night. And I asked them, like, what do you do about that stuff? And they were like, well, if something wakes me up in the night, I write it down. And then I go back to sleep, you know? And they can go back to sleep because they don't have to wonder if they'll forget what they were working on, right? And so I think naming our emotions can have a similar kind of a sticky note function. It's like, yeah, I'll come back to that. I noted it.
Mm-hmm.
And if we feel confident that that's sufficient to return to that examination of whatever's going on, then the down regulation of the anxious feelings and the ramped up physiology that goes with some of those emotions can happen at least enough. It might not go away, but it can go kind of settle enough that we can kind of keep going with the conversation.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah. Well, so some of the challenge for this is built in, is sort of the short version, right? It's how we arrive in the conversation as a human being, and that just makes them difficult. Given that that's the case, what are some things that we can learn if we're being deliberate about it? You called them, I think, in some of our emails back and forth. You talked about foundational principles, things that we can learn or come to understand or believe that can equip us better for these kinds of conversations.
Somebody that I read, and I wish I could remember who, because I think it's delightful, the idea is to have the scout mindset, to be curious, open, grounded, and to really just think about the concept that our self-worth isn't based on being right. That curiosity is really vital. I remember coming through a time of workplace dynamic where the team was fairly well functioning, but we were going through the usual phases where we were actually coming into some open conflict, and to manage that, I remember our manager advising us to be curious about why your coworker did what they did before you come at it from a different stance and go, you shouldn't have done that. And that kind of curiosity has served me well in navigating some of these conversations. If you kind of go into it with a scout mindset, a scientist mindset, like whatever image works for you in terms of, it is a realm of discovery, because there is nothing in the discovery that says actually that you have to change, but you are understanding something more. So put change, be willing to change, be willing to understand that change isn't a bad thing, but put it on the back burner until you really understand where this person's coming from.
I find that one of my, I have a friend who's, this is what they do, is conflict resolution. That's their business. Wow, how was your day at the office, honey? Well, You know, they're very careful about not telling professional stories out of context, but they've said enough for me to know that sometimes the days are pretty interesting. But one of their core principles is that is simply that. They would just say the single best skill in a conflict is stay curious. Just stay curious.
Yeah, that there's makes sense.
There's
to
something
me.
Here to learn. And the fact is, like you, I'm going to get philosophical just a little bit for a moment because I can't help it. But this idea that that we can't absolutely know anything because we can't know everything, right?
Yeah.
And so just that idea should inform a kind of openness about whatever convictions we hold as being incomplete. That doesn't mean they're not useful or good, right? We can still take them and we can operate in the world with them. But the hubris, the unwarranted arrogance of there's no other way to think about this but the way that I think about it, that's just a fundamental barrier to having difficult conversations.
Yeah.
And it immediately feeds into binary thinking. I'm right and you're wrong.
Yeah. We're very unlikely to be right about everything and we're very unlikely to be wrong about everything. And if we can get out of that idea of, especially around the whole tribalism, our tribe is unlikely to be right about everything. So, and if we're going to, can we see this as a gift in the refining of our ideas? Can we see it as a gift that if somebody points out something that our logic did not quite get right, that is actually good for us? That would be part of it. I heard just on a podcast within the last couple of days about somebody who wrote in to the host and they said, you know, I kind of agree with that guy you were interviewing, but then I went online and looked him up and I realized he's this, that, and the other thing. And he wasn't part of that guy's tribe. So he was just having this moment of, I don't like that I agreed with him because he's not the person that I want him to be to have these good ideas. And
yeah.
So it really involves that idea of just like, I am not likely to be right and wrong about everything. Even people that I view as quite different than me are not likely to be wrong about everything. And they're likely to be right about some stuff. So if I can keep that in mind and not feel threatened by it, it gives a good basis.
I think that, yeah, I hear you about that, Judy. And I would personally probably alter the language a little bit if I was saying the same thing or same idea, in the sense that I would just sort of, through my lens, I would stay away from the language of right and wrong, because I'm trying to remind myself that none of my ideas are complete, and right and wrong feel like categories of completeness or incompleteness to me. Like, for something to be right, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing to be wrong. Yeah. There's nothing right. And that way of thinking about right and wrong ideas, I don't find helpful. So same principle, yes. Little different language, in the sense that I just want to say, I don't want to have to rethink this idea of mine. I like it the way that it is. Yeah. And I like the way it works in my tribe, you know, but I can't possibly have solved this thing that this idea is about. There's just no way that that's possible. And so I need to stay curious.
I think for me, there's a part of me that kind of goes with you and a part of me that goes against you. And I'll explain both. The part of me that goes with you is that idea of there's almost all of our ideas have pros and cons to them. And going back to that thing of we want to only highlight the concepts that feed us and make us feel like we are correct, and we want to dismiss the other ones. So if we can embrace the idea that all of our ideas have pros and cons, not necessarily that right and wrong thing, that makes a lot of sense to me. Most things are on a spectrum, not categories, which also helps me make sense of things. Where I still think we need to talk about the right and wrong is because it goes back to that human thing of that is what we fear. So if we can confront the fear of being wrong head on, and go, I can be wrong and be okay. I think that's pretty important.
Yes, I agree with that 100%, Judy. And I just realized as you were describing that, that we were using, as often as the case in challenging conversations, even if we're working to the same end, like we are in this conversation, we can still find the language. And you and I've talked about this before. We can still find the use of language really complicated. So when I was trying to stay away from the binary of right and wrong, I was trying to stay away from categorizing ideas into two bins.
Right.
So to keep them fluid, to say every idea that we have has some merits and some things or strengths and some things that aren't as strong about it and so on. And when you used the word wrong just now, you were talking about the sensation, if I heard you correctly, that I can have that I'm wrong about that.
Yeah.
Which I would say is the same word, but it's being used in a really different way. Because the feeling that I'm wrong about something often tends to really quickly translate into there's something wrong with me.
Yes.
Right. And that's a much more fluid use of the word wrong. It seems like because I could say there's something wrong with me and I'm still not putting myself in a category of I am wrong.
Yeah.
Like as a person, I'm just wrong. I'm a wrong person, as opposed to a person who has an idea that's wrong or an idea that's incomplete or dangerous or hazardous or whatever. Right.
So
that when you use the language that way, all of a sudden I was like, oh yeah, okay. Now I think I'm hearing the way you were using that word in your imagination when you said it out loud more clearly than I was before.
Yeah.
It's really helpful. I can hear the word wrong that way without feeling like I need to push back on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some of those alterations of language may be necessary to get us through these conversations. Like if you're in a place where somehow right and wrong just doesn't have the feel you need to get through, you might not think about incorrect or correct, what's wise, what's unwise, like things like that. Because it's more of the idea of being okay with moving in a direction with your own thoughts. It's being okay with hearing out somebody that actually you might still come to the conclusion that, I don't agree with you.
Would it be fair to say, this is maybe not a very good illustration. Save me for myself if I'm getting lost here, Jude. But it seems to me that sometimes when we watch this kind of stuff get hung up in the everyday world around us, one of the things I feel like we often see is you touched on it when you told the story about the person writing into the podcast host and saying, I kind of liked some of this person's ideas. And then I realized they're not from my tribe. And so, so they're an idiot, whatever sort of dismissive response you might come up with. Right. And that happens. I've done that. Like, I know what that feels like. And so to be able to not fall into that trap of being dismissive because of difference, that takes a kind of bigger mindedness, a bigger spiritedness about the whole enterprise of learning things, of being an explorer, it seems to me. And so I wonder if sometimes it's just helpful to kind of go, in this conversation, I do not wish to be the person who is dismissive.
Mm. Yeah.
I want to be the person who's at least growing their capacity to receive ideas that in the end, I don't find tenable. Right, to be able to hear them, to be able to take them into me far enough that I can process them. Doesn't mean I have to swallow them whole and become them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like to use a phrase for myself that I think everybody has something to teach me.
Yeah.
What they have to teach me may not be what they think I need to learn. But the process of listening usually has some benefit for me.
Does that include, so it's going to be devil's advocate for a moment and go, does that include learning that they're an idiot? No.
Maybe. No. Actually, no, I'm not going to.
No.
I was just glancing at my sheet and going, one of my underlying beliefs that I think are important are beliefs that other people are not significantly different than you. They are not stupid. They are not fragile. They are not evil.
Right.
And because I do think we go there very quickly. You very quickly go, okay, just like we don't want to go there with ourselves. We don't want to get, okay, I was wrong about something. Therefore I should feel shame. We almost sometimes want to do that to the people we see as our enemies is, you know, you are wrong about something. Therefore your motivations must be bad. Your logical thinking must be bad. Like everything about you must be tainted in some way.
Yeah.
And again, this is difficult because tribalism that got us to where we are, got us there because of it was safe to have that idea of the other not being so different than us that they are not worthy.
Well, you know, yeah. And you know, it's interesting, Judy, I think about like our attempts to understand the breakdown of communication and public discourse, for example, in our age, in this hemisphere, we are mining the language of ancient or earlier civilizations, you know, like we're using words like tribalism, right? For example. And it's intriguing to me that if we try, at least as an exercise of imagination, to strip away many of the supports that we have now that allow us to function in such an isolated, individualistic way, we can live with the illusion that we don't need one another very much in our culture in this time, which changes the way we think about an idea like tribalism, right? Because one of the things that if you hit me with a club and kill me or injure me so I can't provide food for my, you know, the people in my tribe, that's a pretty kind of elemental understanding of threat.
Yeah.
But in many ways, our situation, our circumstance is such that I can functionally walk away from this threatening conflict. I can walk away from the person that I feel like their ideas are threatening to me or their tribe is threatening to me or whatever. I can be dismissive. I can ghost them. I can unfriend them. I can not call them back. I can just walk away from them societally and never really feel like I've lost anything.
Yeah.
But I have potentially, and so have they. And not just the exchange of ideas, that's one loss, but the deeper integration of humanity, of my connection to them and their connection to me, of the weakening of the idea of tribalism, or if you wish, don't prefer weakening, then the broadening of the idea of tribalism, like the movement toward one tribe called human instead of this thing called human with a whole bunch of tribes inside of it called mine and yours and left and right and red and blue and whatever, you know, however we name these things. And so that just feels like a really important idea that you just presented of everybody has something to teach me. And mm-hmm. I'm not going to start with you might be evil or you might be so, your idea might be so alarming that it should be squelched. It should cease to exist. It should cease to be included in the discourse. Another conversation for another time. But I know you and I have touched on some of the things that have to do with the way people get silenced in public discourse in our culture these days. And so that's an instance of the danger of not starting with the assumption that you have something to teach me, even if I don't like it. Mm-hmm. Or I don't, in the end, accept it or take it into my worldview. Yeah. Yeah. It might just make clearer for me something that I already thought was difficult or dangerous. Like that's also learning.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
To ignore a legitimate threat is not a very wise way to live. So if this turns out to be a true danger, or a wider danger, yeah, this idea is more deeply hazardous, then the best way for me to actively do something about that in the interest of a better relationship or better world or resolution of the issue is still to know it better.
I think that's a good point. Did you ever see the documentary on Daryl Davis? No. Have you heard of Daryl Davis, first of all?
Not okay. A familiar name.
So Daryl Davis... Oh, you've got to see. Actually, everybody who's watching this, go watch it. I think it's on Canopy, so you can get through the library. Daryl Davis is probably best known as a jazz musician, but he's also become this incredible speaker on race relations. And it began for him as a youth, when he experienced racial attacks, and he didn't understand it. Because the question in his mind was, how can they hate me when they don't even know me? So that just became a passion for him until he became an adult and he started talking to the KKK. And he started having these deep conversations where he really asked these probing questions about why they thought the way they did. End result is, because of the way he approached this, he approached them with respect as humans, not for their beliefs, but he approached them with respect. He approached them with curiosity, and that developed into real conversation. And he has had, I don't even know how many dozens of KKK members give up their membership in the KKK. And he has collected tons of their robes as a result. And that
gave me a little bit of a prickly on the back of my neck. But anyway, it's a great story.
I know.
Yeah.
And it's true.
And I'm assuming.
So the documentary like follows him as well as like talks to some of the people who he convinced to drop their membership. Hmm. And. But, now, why did I get on that? I guess the idea of that seeing I think many of us want our core value to be that we find the value in all people. We actually want to live that. I mean, I think that's why those of us that go to church is that we in part, we are seeing the value of these core values that we've seen in the Bible, in Jesus' life, things like that. And so we are just living out something that we actually want to live when we come into conversation, being willing to hear people out, even if it's uncomfortable. And I think the other thing that really stands out for me there is the not using terms for other people that are derogatory, even if we think that they are accurate or we have a right to use them. Like Daryl Davis would not have had any success in having conversations if he had started by saying, well, you're just racist. You are, you know, embedded in racism. He ignored those kinds of terms. And I'm seeing that as being difficult for a lot of people. Based on online stuff largely, like I've seen if people push back against the term racism, like they'll just dig down deep and they go, well, it is racist and we should call it out and things like that. And that might be morally justifiable, but it's unlikely to be helpful.
And so
whether we're, sorry.
I was just going to say some of that's contextual as well, right? Like there's a moment for the calling out. There's a moment for the naming of things like racism, and productive conversation might not always be that moment.
Yeah.
Right.
And maybe there is those moments, but I think we assume it too much.
Well, it can be like a shortcut I am... too, right? It can be a way of not having a difficult conversation. We can skip over all the complexities and the nuances and the possibilities. Yes. And just name the thing with a categoric term. And even if the categoric term is by definition correct, we've still skipped all of that process that might have helped us know the people in the process in a way that actually could produce change.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I think I told this story in a talky bit, but I couldn't remember. I was thinking about it earlier today and I didn't have time to go check all the notes that would be involved. But the story about, if you're living in the Bay Area and you're tweeting about how, you know, Trump's a nasty person who makes it hard for people to find affordable places to live, why don't you get involved in a local organization that provides affordable housing?
Mm.
You know, and so there's a way in which the local action or the local conversation, the personal, actually makes it much harder to keep things in categories. So we're having this conversation. I just realized, like, I've used the word idiot twice, at least by my count, in this conversation, which by any definitional measure is ableist language, right? Like, we don't use it that way typically in our culture right now, but it's the language we used for mental health in many instances for a long, long time. So not a word that I typically include in my vocabulary. And I, by choice, I used it deliberately in this conversation because it gets used online so much. And I wanted to gesture toward that entire category of dismissiveness online. So I chose a buzzword from it consciously.
Yeah.
And then when, as we were talking, one of the things that occurred to me was that might work as an illustrative device, but it still means I'm using a word that categorizes people, even if I'm using it in an illustrative way or in a way to try to make a point about something that I don't want to do or be, I'm still going there. And so that kind of, for me at least, that kind of reflection helps me to stand back from some of my own inclinations that are not helpful, which include being dismissive. Usually ideologically, I'm just like, that's just a bad idea, is not the same thing as the person who has that idea is a bad person. If I'm going to think like that, I should probably stay out of difficult conversations because I know I have ideas that couldn't possibly be all good. No way.
I resonate with that idea that it can become just a way of dismissing a person. And because if somebody is like, if you're calling somebody an idiot or a libtard or something like that, like coming from the right, and the left tends to use words like racist, homophobic, transphobic, all those kinds of things. But it can be just an excuse to just dismiss whatever sometimes valid concerns that are being raised in a discussion, which can be full of nuance. While I hear what you're saying about, you know, maybe there is a time for calling out, maybe. But I think the calling out comes where we really dig down to go, what am I trying to say with that word? And am I willing to check that out? Like, if I'm talking to somebody who doesn't, like, I love the idea of universal basic income, for example. If I talk to somebody who didn't think that was a good idea, like, I could get on my soapbox and just go, well, you just don't care about poor people. And and that could be like totally not true at all. But am I willing to check that out and go, well, like, do you think that we should do something to help poor people? And what do you think that is? And things like that.
And lots of times, not always, of course, but often in those conversations, my experience has been that that when I get down to that core human thing, or closer to it, at least, like you just did with, do you care about poor people? Like, do you care about people whose life is not like yours, essentially?
Mm-hmm.
I find out, boy, you know what? Most of us humans actually do care about one another.
Yeah.
Now, the way you think we should care for other people, let's say the poor as a category, might be radically different than my idea about that. You might have a rather well thought out political and socioeconomic approach to caring for the poor that is nothing like universal basic income. But I may discover in giving you the opportunity and conversation to tell me about that you and I share the same care for the poor.
Yes.
You know, as an illustrative possibility, I might discover that you really don't believe that poor is a defensible category and that if everyone just did like you did and pulled yourself up by your bootstraps, no one would be poor. In which we probably won't have a very productive conversation about caring for the poor, but then I'll know what's going on, right? And and even in terms of even in terms of deciding where I'm going to put my energy as a human, who I'm going to have the next deeper conversation with, who I might wish to become or initiate a friendship with, who I might choose to divulge things about myself as a person or my ideas that feel vulnerable or I know are unformed. You know, the things that make me feel afraid when I share them, where I'm like, if somebody doesn't get this about me, you know, the possibility of this friendship is probably not that rich, you know, or like those, some of those things feel pretty weighty when we share them. Well, we could keep talking about this for a long time. I know we could, because sometimes we do. But I wanted to, and we sort of just nibbled at this a little bit, and I want to get into it a bit more. Some practical sort of strategies, some really grounded, like, here's the stuff that fits on the back of a business card that I can try to remember when I'm going into a difficult conversation, whether that's about something grand and 30,000 foot-ish, or whether that's just about, I think you ran the red light, not me, or whatever, you know, like everyday, yes. Everyday conflicts, we could say, or challenging conversations. What are some practical things that you feel like you've learned or bumped into in your own reading and thinking about this, Judy?
One thing that I find has helped me reformat how I approach conversations is, I'm taking the right, wrong language again, but if this person is right, how would I know? Because that helps me to ask good questions. Let's think. Start from the premise that maybe this person is right about something. How would I actually know that? What would I need to see? So you start to divulge in questions that explore the reasons for their belief, and it brings about more understanding. Another one is to admit the cons of your own viewpoint. Mm. Just to be very realistic about almost every... I often think of this in terms of policy, because like I listed universal basic income as something that I think is a good idea. But if I'm going to be realistic about it when I'm talking to somebody, I have to realize that there's going to be deficits to such a policy if it was ever implemented, as well as benefits. And to not pretend that I don't have that. One of my points that I was thinking of in advance was letting go of straw men and avatars. Hmm. I'm not sure if you know what I mean by that.
Well, I know what I imagine, but why don't you tell me what you mean by that?
The idea that sometimes we need people to feel good. We need to have them look like something. We need for them to be the person we think they are in our minds, to have the motivations we think they have, to think the way they think they have. And sometimes when we really start to question, we realize they are not. Like the guy that I heard from the podcast, like, to him, the idea of who this guy was that they had interviewed, if he was, you know, from such a religious group and he was from this idea, then he should not have had the nuanced and intelligent conversation that he did. He had to let go of an avatar if he was going to continue to feel good. And then straw manning is the idea of, though, more people's ideas. We often build up what we need other people to believe so that we can tear their ideas down. Mm-hmm. And a few months ago, I heard somebody use the word steel man. To steel man another person's ideas instead of straw man is to actually try to be able to save them in a way that is strong and the person that you're talking with would actually agree with and say, yep, you're understanding me right. So take it as a personal challenge to try to replay somebody's viewpoints, say back somebody's viewpoints in a way that they would go, yeah. You are understanding me now.
So just, I feel like the steel manning idea, which is not a phrase that I've ever heard used for what you described before, in counseling practice, that's just about deep listening and restating in your own words to reflect what you've heard and give the other person a chance to say, yes, that's what I was trying to say, or almost, but not quite, or man, you missed that by a mile. Let me try again, you know, but to keep the conversation going, right?
Yeah.
That's a really interesting, that's a very interesting idea to me. The idea of trying to, as positively and clearly as possible, restate what you think you've heard someone say, even if it's something you profoundly disagree with, to make sure that you've got it clear. Yeah. That's something you've demonstrated a real commitment to in some of our conversations, Judy, an overt commitment to. And I know, as the person on the other end of that experience, that's been really positive. That's a very trust-building thing to experience with somebody, where you're just like, you know, I don't even think we're ever going to get to the same page about whatever we're talking about. And it's not that it doesn't matter, because of course the issue matters, or we wouldn't be, you know, digging into it. So it can matter to me, and so can the person that I disagree with.
Yeah.
Because if people that we disagree with can't matter to us, man, our world is shrinking really, really fast. And basically it's shrinking toward the size of me.
Yeah. Where I have found some of our recent conversations interesting that way is that I'm actually not sure we disagree, but I think
you could be right. Yeah.
We are our concerns are about different things.
Hmm.
And I'll give you an illustration, not from our conversations, but something I once observed in a couple that were close enough to me to argue in front of me. Hmm. And I realized as I was watching them, the basic thing was that because of his position in an organization, he had heard about this kind of what he thought was confidential information, which he had never shared with his wife, who then encountered somebody who was part of the whole thing. And they talked to her as if she would have already known it, because of course your husband's involved in this situation.
Right.
And she was like, she kind of felt embarrassed that it seemed as if her husband didn't talk to her or share things with her. So they were talking about the same incident, but they were talking about two entirely different things. He was talking about his confidentiality clause. She was talking about the need for him to trust her with information that she thought was public, and to communicate with her. So there can be that idea that even though we're talking on the same subject, we're not talking about the same subjects.
And you, I know this story wasn't about Corrine and I, but it could be. I feel like, yeah. I've been that guy in that conversation, you know, more or less. Yeah. So I know what that feels like too. And to just go, yeah, that's right. You know, and I think lots of times it gets back to the, what do I care about? Like, what's the sense of oughtness inside of me? The thing that I think is wrong or incomplete or needs to change. Like we can so deeply agree, boy, you know, people should have a safe place to go to at the end of the day that's warm and secure, and they should have enough to eat.
Mm-hmm.
That's just basic. Everyone, just because they're a human, should have that. Well, that might be about as big as the definable piece of common ground we could come to is, and then everything from there can be divergent. There might be a million ways to think about why that should be the case. Maybe the reason I just gave, because they're human, maybe that's not your reason. Maybe you have another way of thinking about that. I was looking for something that felt really common, but that might not be it even, you know? And yeah. So when we start to dig into that stuff though, we might discover, among other things, that we have an ally that operates in a realm that we would never ever be comfortable in. And that's kind of an interesting idea. I know this past week in the talking bit where I was talking about this, these ideas about hope, that thinker, that writer, when he talks about that, being astute with our hope, talks about looking for allies. And one of the illustrations I can remember him using is that he's just like, on climate change, for example, most of the time when we're talking about climate change and assailing that problem, we're talking to people that already agree that there's a problem.
Yeah.
But if we're actually going to change that problem, one of the things he would say that he's convinced about is that we need to get people on board that don't already think that way. So we need to wake up in the morning and go, where can I find people that woke up this morning, looked at the world around them and went, hey, this is great. I'm going to figure out how I can make a whole bunch of money today. Because that's not necessarily the climate activist. Yeah. Ideologically, right? That might be the like the free market, free range capitalist just running wild in the world and going, I really don't care about the climate cost of this. I just want to make a bunch of money. But if that person can become an ally, if they can come to understand that their ability to look at the world as a problem to be solved toward an end could be turned to this end as well, you've just made an ally in a group of people that don't think like you.
Yeah.
And without those kinds of cross-pollinations, without those kinds of relationships being built, there's any number of things that are profoundly not well in the world that are never going to be as deeply addressed as they could be.
Yeah.
So maybe that's great. You know, that might be a grand-ish illustration. Maybe we're really just trying to explain to our spouse or partner or friend that we didn't try to keep a secret from them. It's not that we didn't trust them. It's that we thought that what we were, had been told was not something we should share with anyone.
Yeah.
And so we wanted the trust of the person who shared that with us.
Yeah.
So we were behaving in a manner of somebody who trusts, but we didn't, you know, and all of those kind of things. But they only come out when we dig into the layers, right?
The climate change example really helps me to think of that idea of we can be very either or thinkers, and by engaging with people who are not, who have different priorities maybe than us, we can become both. And the illustration that's coming to mind is a book I read a while ago, and I wish I remembered the name or the author or anything, but it was about somebody who was in charge of a carpeting company, and he became convinced that there did need to be some changes for his company because of climate impacts or environmental impacts. And so the current thinking at that time was like, you could either have profit or you could be good to the earth. And he kind of refused to do the either or, and he led the company into greater profits while actually reducing their carbon footprint to almost zero. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was even zero. I can't remember, but it was a fascinating read. And, you know, some of this also goes back to when we were talking about the Jonathan Haidt Righteous Mind book, is that we all have these core values of, and I'm not going to remember them all, but like, to not harm, to be fair, usually an amount of liberty and things like that. Like almost every person and every culture group, every country, you can research and find that these core values are present in some sense. We might prioritize them different. We might see like that in some cases harm is justified because of such and such, but we really all do have the same values. Unless maybe you're a psychopath, then I'm not so sure about it.
We might discover that the expression of those values looks or sounds or is expressed so differently that if we didn't have the conversation, we wouldn't have been able to recognize its existence in this person or their practice.
Yeah.
There's just so many reasons to, there's so many reasons to be better at this.
There really is.
They're personal, they're collective, they're global. Just lots of good reasons. Judy, I think let's wrap it up there in the interest of time, because it's not like we're going to exhaust this. But my hope is, on behalf of the community, is certainly that a conversation like this one can be the catalyst for other conversations, so that we would be better equipped in our own lived experience to have difficult conversations. Absolutely. That we would be encouraged to have difficult conversations in the personal realms, but also in the kind of wider realms of ideas and beliefs. And that somehow out of a conversation like this, we would kind of be heartened. We would realize that other people share our fears and our challenges, and that hopefully that can help to dial some of those things down in our own experience a little bit. Just give us a little bit more courage, a little bit more imagination, a little bit more curiosity to just keep exploring, right?
Yeah, it's my hope too.
Awesome. Judy, thanks so much. For this conversation, I mean, that's our context, but for all the ways that your curiosity about things as a person is such an integral part of the life of curiosity of the community at the table, the life of exploring what we believe. It's a rich contribution, and I'm grateful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being the type of leader in our congregation that actually values this kind of dynamic. That's also important.
I appreciate the affirmation, and I will continue to try to stay on that path.
Sounds good.